What's up, everybody? Another episode of Republic Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Verendez. And today we got a great guest, somebody I was really excited to finally get a hold of and finally have on the show. I've been trying to get him on the show probably since the beginning of the show. And sometimes that's the way it works. I just happen to give it another try, throw another email, throw another call. However, I try to get a hold of the guests and somebody gets back to me and they're willing to come on. So I was really excited to have Joel Salatin on. He's probably the most famous farmer in the U.S. I became familiar with his work years ago when he was on the Joe Rogan podcast. This was, I think he was on in the 700s on the Joe Rogan podcast. Joe's now over 1,000 and something. So it was quite a few years ago, but he's also recently been on London Real. He's an author of many, many books. I mean, you go on Amazon and you can farm, your successful farm business. Everything I want to do is illegal, salad bar beef, just so many books. And I'll put in the show notes, I'll put links to his Amazon page where you can see all his books. And just a really interesting conversation. We talk everything about the issues with modern farming, the issues with modern food, GMOs. We talk about not just farming, but everything connected to it, from community and the benefits of appreciating the food and all that stuff. So really smart guy, unbelievably knowledgeable when it comes on to the science of the food and the soil and the farming techniques and all that stuff. So enjoy the show. Like I said, on our YouTube channel, RV Theory 6, in the show descriptions, I'll put links to his farm, Polyphase Farms in Virginia. I'll put a link to that website and also look him up, like I said, on London Real, on the Joe Rogan podcast. Great conversations. And he's also done some TED Talks, so look that up. And also remember to follow me on Instagram, RV Theory 6, Twitter, RV Theory 6. Our YouTube channel, RV Theory 6. Find me on Facebook, my personal page, Ricky Verandas, or you can find our Facebook page for the Ripple Effect podcast, where I'm always sharing the podcast, but I'm also always sharing articles relevant to the topics we talk about on the show. So things about GMOs, things about pesticides, things about big pharma, big food, all these things. So I'm always sharing documentaries, all that stuff. But more importantly, you guys, please also share. If you find this conversation important, like I always tell you, please share. I have a Patreon page. I really appreciate everybody who does contribute. If you can't, I know money's tight. It's tight for me. I'm sure it's tight for everybody else too. And just share the podcast. You never know who's listening and who you're going to reach by just doing the simple task of sharing the show, retweeting it, posting it on your Facebook page or whatever. And this is all open source, so feel free to do it. And I guess that's it. So thanks again, guys, for being with me. I know sometimes we go a couple weeks without a show, then I'll put a couple quick ones out. This one's hopefully will be out very soon. And I have one I just did recently on the RFK assassination, which I'll put out before this one. And hopefully you get both of these back to back and you have plenty of hours of the Ripple Effect podcast to listen to. Which to some people, I'm sure, is torture. If you ask my wife, listening to hours of me talking is what she's done most of her life, and she hates it. So it's always amazing to know how many people download this show and listen. But thanks again, guys. I'll see you on the next one. Peace.
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for being with me. I really appreciate your time. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And I think the first time I heard you was on the Joe Rogan podcast years ago. And it's farming's one of those things where it's kind of near and dear to my heart, because I was born in Portugal on a little farm, and my parents have always been farmers. And a lot of things that were normal to me growing up weren't so normal to some of my friends who weren't used to it. And you know, like, I remember we used to play in a metal band, and we went in the garage once for band practice, and there was a pig hanging upside down, you know, because my parents were carving it and all that stuff. And even like just seeing my parents skin a rabbit and all that stuff. it was all weird to a lot of my friends. And to me, it was completely normal. And then it hit me as I got older that, you know, things that I kind of took for granted, it helped me understand where our food came from. And at a young age, I understood that the things I was eating at dinner time were things that were killed and lived, and you appreciate them. And then I always had this dilemma when I was a kid, because it was weird, because it's like, I know my parents could go to a grocery store and just buy food, but why would they grow it and then kill it and then, you know, raise it and kill it? And I'm always like, well, I don't get it. If they kill the animal, that means they must not like animals. But if they didn't like animals, why would they go through the work of raising it? And then as I got older, you know, I realized, like, my parents love animals. But it was just a cycle of life that they understood. And
right. And
you know, as a kid, it was always confusing to me, because I'm like, I don't get it. They tell me they like animals, but they end up killing them, you know. And but so I think all these little weird life lessons that I was gaining from just being around farmers, because even though my parents, you know, they have a couple acres now where we live in Massachusetts, but they still have, you know, they've had goats, they have chickens, they have rabbits, mm-hmm. and they, you know, they grow their own vegetables and stuff like that. And, you know, it was something I never really thought much of. But as I got older, I really started appreciating it more, because, you know, I tell my friends, I'm like, you know, if the world ended, you want to hang out with my parents, because they could survive just fine. If we didn't have supermarkets or Amazon to order what we needed,
right,
we'd be screwed, you know. So it's
right.
I think these are all really important skills. And I mean, do you think it's something that we're losing, that, you know, people who understand even the simple things of just knowing how to grow food are crucial skills of survival that now are lacking?
Well, yes. You know, Wes Jackson, author of Altars of Unhewn Stone, says that we're actually, for all of our hubris about having an information explosion, we're actually having an information implosion. And the things that we're substituting are not always the best. I mean, we're substituting intimate knowledge of the dysfunctional Kardashian household for intimate knowledge about how to grow a tomato or something. And so it's a, you know, it's a strange trade-off to learn things. You know, the average American male plays 20 hours of video games a week. Well, that's a skill and a knowledge level, but is it really important?
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, because the thing is, like, growing up, it was weird, because my parents weren't educated in the sense of you know, schooling and that type of education. But so growing up, because I was similar to them, I never really cared for school, and I, you know, it didn't, nothing really, they couldn't really hold my attention in school. And I always thought it was just because I didn't like to learn. And then I got older, I realized, no, it wasn't that I didn't like to learn. It was the fact that our school systems suck and it's boring, and they don't know how to get kids to engage. And they ask kids to sit down at a desk for 6 hours a day, when really what they want to do is move and use up all this energy. And you've been around animals. I always use animals as a perfect example. I'm like, if you see babies, it doesn't matter what animal it is, they all play. They're full of energy. They're rolling around. They're wrestling. I'm like, why do you think humans would be any different? But you're asking kids with all this built up energy to sit down, and if they don't sit down for a long periods of time, then they must have something like ADHD or some issue where we can prescribe them a drug, you know. So I think we can probably learn a lot just from being around them, and just how peaceful it is. From you know, I'm a big bourbon drinker, and I like occasional cigar on weekends. And there's something about smoking a cigar somewhere, like in the middle of a casino, or smoking a cigar in the backyard with some animals making some noise and some trees. It's like, it's a complete different experience. It's like not even the same thing, you know. So I think there's something, some attachment to nature that we're missing out on too.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, Richard Louv wrote the book Nature Deficit Disorder and coined the term Nature Deficit Disorder, and I certainly am a big fan of what he has found in his research and connecting those dots. And there's a certain humility that comes with tactile interaction with nature, because you find out that you're not the center of the universe. And I think that to take video games for example, you know, if your icon dies or gets blown up or whatever, you know, you wait 10 seconds and the game gives you a new one. But when you're growing a tomato, for example, you're an 8-year-old and you're growing a tomato, and if the tomato plant dies, you don't just wait for a second and nature gives you a new tomato. I mean, this is for all the marbles. And I think being participants viscerally in nature, to understand that, you know, we're just a piece of something way bigger than us, really gives us a much better perspective of life, of the world, and how things actually work.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, that concept of us all being one, it's when you really look at the way, you know, when you look at how animals or plants, everything dies, it ends up getting absorbed by the soil, which ends up feeding some other animals or life, and everything kind of just cycles within one another. Like, when you see that and you experience that, you realize, like, we really are all one, and we're all connected in probably some weird way that we can't really explain. And
this cycle, it's the life, death, decomposition, regeneration. I mean, and of course the regeneration is often in a totally different a different form. What the compost pile grows may not have anything to do with what actually went in the compost pile to start with, but the whole, you know, life, death, decomposition, regeneration is just so foundational to the whole ecological picture. And it does speak to the fact that in order to have life, something has to die, whether it's a carrot or a cow or whatever. That everything is eating and being eaten. I mean, that's how the bacteria and the mycorrhizae and the fungi and all that, that's how they all function. It's all just eating and being eaten. And how we create sacredness to that sacrifice of something, you know, being the life of the beginning of life for something else. The way we create sacredness there is by respecting the physiology and the phenotypical expression of that life, of that being in life, whether it's a carrot or a cow, appreciating the carrotness of the carrot and the cowness of the cow in life, and respecting and honoring that creates sacredness to the sacrifice that it gives for something else to live.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. You hear hunters talk about that all the time, how they appreciate the meat more because of the fact that, you know, they saw it alive, they were, they killed it, and you appreciate what you're eating more than if you just buy it packaged in a store. And a lot of things like farming and hunting and all these things that sound like murders of the vegetarians, you appreciate your food much more. And I've told people in the past, I'm like, if plants had mouths where you could hear them screaming while you're, you know, chewing on them, then we would have a much different opinion on eating meats more cruel than eating plants. And you've talked about it in the past, you know, how plants are much smarter than we understand, and just because they don't have mouths, they don't make noises, you know, when you see these factory farms and you see these animals crying or screaming while they're being killed or whatnot, it pulls on some heartstrings. But just because plants don't make those noises and can't show the same, you know, the similar emotions that we can understand and register, it doesn't mean that, you know, it isn't the same process.
Well, yeah, and the whole idea of sentience, I mean, that's always the dividing line. Well, these are sentient beings. Well, just a couple of examples that we know now, that we know from nature. I mean, let's take, for example, maple trees. We tap maple trees for syrup here on the farm, and when a heavy wind comes up, a maple tree withdraws its sap. It won't let any sap come out because it's storing it lest a limb fall off, and it need to rush that sap, which is like the blood of the tree. It needs to run that sap to a big wound, say a branch falls off, and needs to heal that. As soon as the wind stops, then the tree gives you sap again. You know, if that's not sentience, I don't know what is. In you know, we know that in, for example, in Africa, the Serengeti, the acacia trees, and other species of trees emit pheromones that make the leaves bitter. And as giraffes graze, so when a leaf gets grazed, it sends this pheromone signal out to its neighbors, and it changes the chemical complexity of the leaf to make it bitter, so the giraffe doesn't like it as much. That's why the giraffes always graze upwind in order to try to stay ahead of this tree language that's telling the neighbors to, you know, change your chemical compounds. Again, if that's not sentience, I don't know what is. And the truth is that all of nature is pulsing with a sentient understanding. I mean, that's the difference between life and mechanics, between things that live and things that are inanimate. You know, a bearing in your car, it has no sentience. I mean, it doesn't know or care or do or think or respond to anything. But all anything that's alive, plant, animal, anything that's alive, does indeed respond to all sorts of things, and change its own. I mean, a Venus flytrap, for crying out loud. I mean, there's all sorts of this kind of thing, and so to assume that because animals, you know, moo or cluck or growl. And therefore, or have eyes, you know, like we have, and look more like us, and therefore they're more important than plants, is to take an extremely you know, human-centric, egocentric view of all of life. The truth is, probably the most important life is the bacteria, and the fungi. You know, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't have functional soil, and then we wouldn't have plants. And, you know, you can go on down the ladder.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just now there's a lot of, I mean, recently, you know, the last couple of years, there's been a lot of documentaries against eating meat and all this, you know, cherry picking facts on its effects on the public's health, it affects on the climate. You know, the guys from like Cowspiracy and stuff like that, they actually when that documentary first came out, they actually asked to be on my show, and I remember looking into the documentary, I can't have these guys on because I don't agree with them, and I think that the information is kind of cherry-picked. And
sure.
Then what the health is another, or what the wheat or whatever the hell it was called, that
what the health?
Yeah, what the health was another one. And I mean, I know people that literally changed the way they ate after watching that. And it's propaganda, I guess, for a lack of a better term, you know, because I'm not saying that all the information is wrong, but there's a lot of cherry picked information. And
The way I view that is that what they're studying, you know, a lot of the indictments of the current factory farming system, chemical agriculture, industrial agriculture, whatever you want to call the current orthodoxy, a lot of the data is exactly correct. The problem is that when you the answer is not to go off to another planet. The answer is to change the dysfunction of what you're studying. I wrote an article once. The title was "It's Hard to Study What Ain't," and so because all their data points are coming from conventional, you know, feedlot, chemicalized, aquifer irrigated. I mean, we can go on and on and on. Soil depleting kind of systems. Then obviously that's going to lead you to a dysfunction, and you're going to say, "Ooh, you know, it's better not to have this." I mean, I liken it to imagine if you and I were from Pluto and we volunteered to go down to Earth and study their educational system. So we get in a little flying saucer, we fly down to Earth, and we land in the worst school district with the worst superintendent in the worst school, with the worst principal in the classroom, with the worst teacher, with the worst kids who have the worst parents. In the country, we study it for 2 days. We go back to Pluto, and they say, "Well, what'd you find?" And we'd say, well, goodness, they'd be better off if they didn't have any education.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, so, you know, when you study, when all you study is dysfunction, you know, you don't get the true picture. And you're exactly right. They have cherry picked. I mean, I've talked to ranchers that they filmed in the film, and I mean, they completely misquoted, took quotations out of context. I mean, these guys are actually, you know, evil manipulators with data and with, you know, verbiage. And I mean, they're very agenda driven, you know, and people, you know, unfortunately, I kind of call this whole, you know, vegan anti-animal movement basically an urban disease. It's certainly being, you know, pushed in the cities. It's being bought by cities, primarily by people who have never, you know, whose only relationship with an animal is a pet dog or a cat or a gerbil or a boa constrictor or whatever. They've never closely participated with animals in their, you know, in their functional environment. And as a result, there's just a lot of ignorance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I remember growing up going to Portugal, or even here, they do it here where, you know, the Portuguese have this stew where they take every part of the pig and they end up making a stew out of it. You know, nothing goes to waste. And this was, you know, farmers would do this because you basically didn't have a lot of money. So you got creative and you made food with every part of the pig to make sure nothing goes to waste. And there's this beautiful thing about enjoying the you know, the food and the celebration that the pig brings. It brings communities together. It brings people together. It becomes this festivity of people coming together. So, you know, just outside of appreciating the food, a lot of the stuff, I mean, I really appreciate how farming and killing the animals and how everybody does it together, how it actually becomes this communal thing, which is super important, I think, that we're lacking in modern times. Just you know, I've done shows on what really causes depression and all this other stuff, and you know, a reoccurring theme, you know, and Dr. Christopher Ryan's talks a lot about this, and just how we're tribal people. We're happier when we're together in groups, you know, and we're happier when we're and the thing about farming and stuff like that and doing this stuff together is it does that. You know, you're together, you're appreciating it, everybody's coming together and having a good time. So I think there's tons of positives in these old ways of living, and there's a reason why you see people, you know, farmers who, like yourself, I mean, I think you're 60 or 61. I mean, you're in amazing shape. You're still working and you know, still get your hands dirty. And I think there's a reason why you see people living these unnatural lives of being in cubicles and you know, their bodies just shut down, and food just becomes this thing that you just kind of, it's just about filling yourself up and just moving on to work so you can get as many hours in as possible, or get as much work as possible. It's such an unnatural lifestyle. And, you know, I remember my dad used to tell me, you know, when he came to America, he's like, I should have stayed in Portugal. I was happier there. And I'm like, well, in Portugal, you didn't have a TV. You didn't have any, you know, you didn't have any of the luxuries you have here. Why would you want to go back to Portugal? And I remember as I got older, like I started understanding, I'm like, yeah, but he had community. You know, I remember once like his TV wasn't working. He called me over and he was all like, oh, we got to get this TV working. And I'm like, Dad, how many years did you live in Portugal without a radio, TV? You know, you didn't have running water. And he's like, oh, you're right. And we all played cards and we were just, you know, we were happier than we are here, you know. And I'm like, exactly, you know. And everybody drank, and Portuguese culture, you know, everybody always had an accordion at home. Somebody takes out the accordion, all of a sudden, you know, it's free entertainment. People are dancing, drinking, eating. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of things about this packaged food that, you know, this is another, I think, a side effect of it, is that it also prevents us from having to come together and eating together. We can just eat on the go, you know, fast food, you know, or processed food, you know, just grab it and go. Yep. And so there's this, you know, growing up, my mother would, like, I could never miss family dinner. It was the most important thing. If I got an F on a report card, she'd be a little mad. But if I missed family dinner, it was the end of the world. And now I appreciate that. You know, I hate eating alone. I always make my family eat together. And it's that time where we all get to enjoy each other's company and spend some time together. Because if we don't do that, then we're just roommates. We're just kind of taking care of priorities and stuff, but we're not actually spending any quality time.
Yeah, you know, you really see that in other cultures, especially if you travel much. And America seems to me like, you know, it's one of the only places where food, our food culture, you know, Prince Charles has been a real friend of sustainable ag. He says a culture is known by its religion, architecture, and food. And America, you know, if you go anywhere in the world and say, well, what, when you say America and food, what do you think? You know, well, they think, you know, McDonald's, right? Fast food.
Yep.
And it's here where we essentially don't have a food culture. Essentially, as you said, food is essentially seen as a pit stop. It's just a pit stop among the things in life that are really, really important. Food has no importance in and of itself. It's just a necessary obstacle to getting along with whatever else is really important. And other cultures don't see it that way. You know, they see it as fundamentally important. And we take it one step further on our farm. You know, our moniker is healing the land one bite at a time, and we want people to understand that food, yes, for all the reasons you're suggesting, communal, family, humility before our dependence upon the earth, and celebration of the abundance of provision. I mean, all those kinds of things are wonderful, but also just the fact that that understanding how we eat, you know, what's actually on the plate is one bite at a time creating the kind of landscape that our grandchildren will inherit. The way we farm, the way we do our food is going to actually determine or not whether we have soil tomorrow, whether we have water tomorrow, whether we have breathable air tomorrow. All those things are based on our menu choices. And so that makes a new imperative, almost a new sacredness, if you will, in our, you know, in our food choices.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's why a lot of these, vegans and stuff like that, their focus shouldn't be on meat eaters, but specifically factory farms and that type of stuff, because that's really where these documentaries really get people motivated not to eat meat. It's like when you see the way these chickens are raised in the dark and they can't walk, and you know, in 48 days they're, you know, 10 times fatter than a chicken was, you know, in months prior to that. And that's the stuff that, you know, but when you look at a farm, I mean, it's you know, that's, so what I'm saying is that they should really focus their energy and focus their anger on the factory farms, not all meat eaters. And, you know, it's become this thing where it's this battle between hunters and farmers and vegans and stuff like that. And I just think that I think in many cases their heart's in the right place. I think that they mean well. They really do care about the environment. They really do care about animals, I guess. But I think that in some sense it's almost ignorance, maybe, like just a lack of understanding of the relationship between farmers and hunters and animals. And even, like I said, I had the same dilemma growing up where I didn't understand how my parents could tell me they loved animals when I was a kid, but yet I watched them kill them. And I'm always like, well, how does that make any sense? I'm just a little boy, and I'm like, I don't get it. You said you love this animal, and now you're killing it. But as I got older, I started to understand that it's like, of course, they could just go to the grocery store and buy something. If they didn't love this animal enough to raise it and give it a good environment, and I would see when there was you know, a coyote or something would kill a chicken or something like that, my parents would be so angry. And I'm like, wait, what do you care? You know, it just, you're going to kill it anyways. But they really did care about those animals. So I think that it is a little bit of ignorance and lack of understanding of that relationship. And probably because of the fact, like you said, they never were in a situation where they watched that relationship and they watched the way that people actually appreciated the food.
Well, you know, what people need to understand, you know, when vegans, you know, say to me, I mean, because I've been told, how can you even be a functional human when you're a murderer, you know, and all this stuff, and what they have to understand is that you know, way more actual animals, you know, from earthworms to mycorrhizae, whatever, actinomycetes, way more animals are killed to produce, for example, tofu, soybeans, than are killed to produce a T-bone steak, and because of all the, you know, the tillage and the herbicides and whatever, you know, monocrops are actually quite quite deathly in the ecosystem. And you know, two things I would just add to that, that is that there is no animal-less ecosystem. You study the world, you look around the world, show me an ecosystem that doesn't have any animals. They're everywhere, and there are a lot of functions for animals in nature. I mean, one is that they they create incredible fertilizer.
Did I lose you?
Of course, they're inefficient. That's why all the best soils on the planet are under herbivores. Plains, the wildebeest on the Serengeti, the pampas of Argentina, the steppes of Mongolia, the middle of America, the bison, all these places were full of mega fauna, primarily herbivores, and that's what made these deep soils. And secondly, you know, there's not, to my knowledge, there's no produce grower, you know, vegetables and grains and things in the world that is able to do it without animals. Every functional system, well, without animals, I mean, unless you use chemical fertilizer, but let's not count chemical fertilizer for a minute. Let's just look at ecosystem function. And what you find is that there is no long-term, sustainable, functional agriculture system that functions without animals.
Because
important functions, turning waste into, you know, high value and things like that. So, you know, this idea that we can, you know, we can sail off into some sort of a vegan future sans animals and have a functional system without chemical fertilizer is just it's a fantasy.
Yeah, and so people who are listening and they don't understand, because we talk about factory farms, and there are, you know, agriculture did bring some issues with, you know, with disease and all this stuff with the modern way of farming. And, you know, obviously our issue with antibiotics, how, you know, basically people are going to become immune to them eventually, because the majority of our antibiotics are going into our animals and, you know, it's having some effect when we're consuming them. For people who are listening who don't know how you do things differently on your farm, well, what's the easiest way of explaining what you do at your farm?
Well, probably the easiest thing is just to explain that on our farm, everything is on pasture. So what you would normally consider of like a confinement dairy operation, where you've got, you know, 3,000 cows in a desert, confined. On a pasture-based farm, those cows would be probably a smaller herd, and they would be, you know, on pasture. Our beef cows are on pasture, and our calves are finished on pasture. We move them every single day, as opposed to putting them in a feed, fatten them up on corn and soybeans and all that. Chickens, same thing. You know, they're out on pasture. We move them every day, and they and instead of being confined in a big, you know, like a Tyson or whatever chicken house, they're out on the pasture, and they do get grain, of course, because they are omnivores. But they also get a fresh salad bar every day, bugs, critters, you know, clover, things like that. Same with the pigs. The pigs are moved along. And so everything that you would normally think of in farming, and you'd normally, you know, see big barns and buildings housing all these things, ours are outdoors on pasture, except for, right, you know, just 100 days in the middle of the winter, and then they're on deep bedding in hoop houses and sheds. When I say deep bedding, I mean really deep bedding, like 12 to 48 inches deep of, we call it a carbonaceous diaper. Again, so they've got, there's no smell, and you've got enough carbon to soak up all the, you know, nutrients coming out of the waste stream, and then that all gets composted and goes back on the fields. So it's we say that good farms should be aesthetically and aromatically, sensually romantic.
And this is the way things were, right, for a long time until, you know, basically, like you brought up Tyson. I mean, we go to a grocery store and it looks like we have a bunch of options, but they're basically all just made to sound like they're coming from local farms. It's all like something farm. This is called, you know, this brand ends with farm. That name is ends with farm, but they're all basically coming from the same companies, right?
Yeah, they're all coming from the same place. At the risk of being nostalgic, we say that what we do is a combination of high tech and old pattern. In other words, we have some of the coolest technology today to be able to do these historic normative patterns that even our grandfathers couldn't have done. And so while we have a great deal of respect for, you know, the old ways, we have now computerized electric fence. We have polyethylene black plastic pipe, so we can actually run water uphill, deliver it everywhere we want to. So on our farm, for example, we have 8 miles of water line that gravity feeds from permaculture-style ponds we built high on the mountain, and give us 80-pound pressure water out over the whole farm without any pumps or electricity. You know, that is really, really 21st century development, okay? We have front-end loaders so we can handle compost. We have commercial chippers, okay, so we can go in the woods and we can chip diseased and dead and down trees so they don't burn, and use those for compost, composting manures. The point is that yes, while there are definite historic templates and patterns, this new technological stuff allows us to, you know, to do even better. One of them is, for example, electrified poultry netting. It's a polyethylene web with tiny little thread filaments of stainless steel wire woven into them, so it could take a charge. And, you know, 150 feet of this only weighs like 12 pounds. You can take it up and put it down in 10 minutes, and it'll keep out bears, coyotes, foxes, keep the chickens in. So you get this wonderful mobile control and protection with a material that has no mass and density to it. It's essentially a psychological thing. I mean, you know, Grandpa would have given his eye teeth for this stuff. So, we're not Grandpa's farm. We're way better than that, but we do have a deep respect for the patterns and templates of nature's patterns.
Now, living in Virginia, are they more lenient with selling food without so many over-regulated, you know, hoops that you have to jump through?
Oh, not really. I mean, a lot of these are federal, you know, federal regs, and it's true every state is different. But Virginia's Virginia's easier on when you have the states. Some states are easier, some states are harder. On different things. For example, in Virginia, they've been pretty lenient on, for example, home processed poultry, as compared to places like, you know, Illinois or something like that. But on, for example, raw milk, 30 states or more than 30 states now, some sort of a raw milk sale is legal, whether it's limited to on your farm, or limited to number of cows, or number of dollars, or whatever. There's all sorts of definitions, but at least some form of raw milk sale is legal. In Virginia, not one teaspoon of raw milk can be sold anywhere. So what you see pretty soon you get into this is the states are there's quite a bit of latitude, and you know, some states now have what are called cottage food laws. That's and you know, that enables you to produce food and sell it, you know, out of your what's called your curtilage, which is kind of your, you know, your farmstead, homestead, where you live. And you know, Virginia, a couple years ago, we got a pickle bill so that you can now do $3,000 worth a year of pickles in your home without any inspection whatsoever. We got a kitchen bill that allows us in Virginia to do baked goods that don't have temperature requirements, baked goods without any regulation whatsoever. All this stuff, of course, is to end user. You can't sell it to Walmart, but you can't sell it to neighbors and friends and you know, direct customers. So some states have taken a broader view. In Virginia, we've been unsuccessful at getting any of these broad view cottage food laws passed, like Kentucky did last year and Wyoming did as well. And so, you know, this is why I'm such a big fan of Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, because, you know, if you join them, you can call with your question and actually get an answer. Don't ever call the government. Don't ever call a bureaucrat, because their answer is no. That's what those folks are paid to do. They're paid to tell you no. So if you don't know what you can do before you call the bureaucrat, you're not ready to call the bureaucrat. And the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, which is modeled after the Homeschool Legal Defense Association that Mike Ferris started, you know, whatever, 40 years ago, the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is modeled after that, and they have, you know, representation, and you can actually, you know, call them and talk directly to somebody that deals with this every day and find out what is, you know, where the legalities are in your own state for your own food system.
Now, for people listening and who hear you talk about, you know, basically selling food with no regulations, how could you put their minds at peace? Because there's a lot of people who believe that, like, if you don't have any regulations, if you don't have anybody overseeing this stuff, then it can cause issues with, you know, people getting sick or whatnot. But obviously, we've seen the opposite happen too, where people were getting sick on food that was regulated. But, you know, I think that it hurts small farms, these regulations, and it makes it really hard for you know, farmers who do just want to sell to their local neighborhoods and stuff like that. But for people listening, because even, like, you know, I wanted to get your opinion also, not to get off track, but I normally do, so bear with me. But if organic and stuff, you know, I have a lot of people who ask me, to like, Ricky, organic, is it worth spending the money? Is it just a government bullshit thing where it's just, you know, you're paying for this this label that you can put on your food, and it's not any better for you, you know, what, you know, and stuff like that. And you know, I've thought about it and I've looked into it, and there's some conflicting opinions on it. Some people say that yes, you know, it's you know, you're basically letting certain companies charge more if they're willing to pay that, you know, for that inspection or whatever it may be to be certified organic. What's your opinion on organic and stuff like that? Should people be paying more for that, or would it just be easier to get something that doesn't say organic but it's local?
Yeah, well, for sure, for me, the short answer for that is there's nothing like the transparency and the integrity that naturally comes with, you know, knowing your source, which for me, local is far more important than organic, because at least then you know. One of the things that's happened with, you know, the government organics, I call it government industrial organics, is that it has become incredibly adulterated and compromised, just like most of the things the government does, right? And so, you know, the big companies now own the certification process. And so, like, you know, now we're certifying in the U.S. We're the only country in the world that's now certifying hydroponics. Well, the whole National Organic Act, when it was put in by Senator Patrick Leahy back, whatever, 30 years ago, was all about soil systems. And so, you know, this is a very obvious departure from the intent and the wording of the law, and yet because the big companies kind of now own the system and have stacked the regulation board and the bureaucracy, they're certifying hydroponics, of course, with no labeling requirements or anything, so you don't know if the tomatoes you're getting, they're organic or they hydroponic or not. And so that's why, you know, people like me suggest, you know, the best thing is to don't trust that government label, but actually find, you know, and when people hear me say, you know, find your food, oh, I don't have time. Well, you know, you don't need to do all the things that you do. Most of us are doing and spending on things that are not necessary, and we have some wiggle room. And this isn't something you have to do every day, but it's like a lot of things up front. You might need to invest a little bit of time and attention on it, but once you punch through and you become skilled at identifying the integrity food, then, you know, you're up and running, and you'll get, you know, more and more skilled at it. And so that's where I am. It was started years ago, like so many of these things, sincerely, but it's certainly been co-opted by the industry now. Now, as far as your other question about no regulations, you know, what, you know, can we not, how can we have safe food without regulations? The truth is that the food recalls and the pathogenicity in the food system are not coming from backyard gardens and, you know, farmers markets and CSAs and direct neighbor-to-neighbor food commerce. They're coming primarily, they're coming from industrial sources. And, we, you know, we don't have a pathogenicity problem in small-scale local food systems, primarily because farmers like us don't have a passel of Philadelphia attorneys standing as a veil between us and our customer. It's just us and the customer, so we tend to be a lot more careful than the industry that hides behind the skirts of a pile of government regulations, licenses, and paperwork. You know, what's the first thing that a CEO always says when there's some big food recall? He calls a press conference, people come in, and he says, we've complied with every government regulation, blah, 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 blah. And so essentially the regulatory situation is a license to be flippant with risk within the industry, because they can always fill out reports and hide behind compliance sheets. And the small farmer or the local, you know, the direct seller doesn't have that privilege. And so as a result, we tend to be way more careful and therefore much less risky than the regulated folks.
What's your opinion on GMOs and like GMO labeling? Well, that's kind of a, I guess that would be kind of an interesting question, because in one way, less government is better. If they get involved, it can make things worse. But yet enforcing something like GMO labeling, couldn't that be beneficial?
Well, I'm a bit of a minority in our movement. I don't like any labeling laws,
really?
And I'm pretty libertarian. So our problem is, you know, we fight with labeling all the time, and we don't want more labeling requirements. Here's my situation with GMOs. I'm opposed to GMOs. Very opposed to GMOs. But there's more than one way to skin a cat, and so my take on GMOs is that if somebody's strange life form trespasses on my property, onto my farm, and suddenly I have life forms that I don't want, I should be able to go down to the magistrate, swear out a warrant, and get that trespasser brought in before the court to, you know, to be liable for the damages for trespassing on my farm. I mean, if you had a bull and your bull came over and trampled my rose bushes, I could take you to court for damages for your bull trampling my rose bushes. So that to me is the check. I mean, here GMOs are an inherently promiscuous life form released into the atmosphere, and here we've got such lopsided justice in our country that not only when GMOs trespass on my farm and give me beings that I don't want, not only is the owner, the patent owner of the GMO, not liable, but the courts have now ruled that I have to pay the GMO owner a royalty for the privilege of his bull coming over and trampling my rose bushes. And so the whole GMO issue, I think, would have, I mean, a lot of people think, well, labeling would certainly help. But and that may or may not be true. But to me, that doesn't deal with the overriding issue, and that is blatant property trespass from the people who own the GMO life forms. And I just think we sell ourselves short when we focus our energy on some sort of a labeling issue rather than dealing with a much bigger issue, which is, you know, how are we going to interact as neighbors?
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. But I also think with very creative manipulation of marketing and all this other stuff, and the fact that a lot of information about like Dr. Cirillini, the French scientist who had the study that showed some correlation between some negative health effects and genetically modified food and pesticides, that information was suppressed
There's been tremendous suppression of information and plenty of information indicting GMOs, and that's why it's pretty black and white. But the problem is, if you say, well, let's ban GMOs, then everybody says, well, you must be anti-science, you're anti-creativity, anti-innovation, blah, blah, blah. So I'm just saying, well, let them do. But boy, but as soon as those life forms trespass, the owner needs to be liable for them, just like I am with my bull or a cow or a pig or anything else. And that would create a renewed degree of care in the system.
Yeah, and I think recently there was Kevin Folta, I think, who resigned, and he was one of those people who were going around and telling people that there's no negative effects of GMOs, and come to find out he was getting all this money from Monsanto and being flown around and all this stuff. And that's the thing. There's, people think that, if it's science and science hasn't proven it to be, not safe, then there's nothing to worry about. But science can be skewed, just like diet and nutrition,
Oh, absolutely.
It's,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Every time I say science is subjective, people just, the science cultists just go bonkers, but it is. I mean, it's, science is limited to what we can see and what we can duplicate. Well, there's a lot of things we can't see, some things we can't duplicate, and so a lot of things are documented per our worldview or our paradigm. Because we see things that aren't real, or we don't see things that aren't real because they don't fit our paradigm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a, I used the example recently on a podcast about the shaking baby syndrome. I don't know if you know anything about this story, but for a while, any kid that was diagnosed with shaking baby syndrome. So if you were a parent and you bring your kids to the hospital because it was having some issues breathing or had a head injury or whatever, and it had these, they basically had these very broad guidelines, like, oh, if according to, you know, what they say shaking baby syndrome is, the parents must have shooken the baby and killed their own child. So these parents were getting locked up. And then these other doctors that had nothing to do with shaken baby syndrome is looking at it, and they're like, listen, what I understand of head damage and head injuries, to hurt their head that much, to have that type of brain damage, you must show some neck injury. And there wasn't any neck injury. But the science and all the, you know, has been going around locking up parents, which for the worst crime, that for the murder of their own child, but yet science was already established, and just like, you know, like the earth being flat, it's like you can't go against you can't say the earth's round because we've already established it's flat, and so these scientists you know, fight against it and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense, and according to the established science at the time, these parents must have done it, but you know, there was holes in the science. So I think what happens is that, like with anything, like people have a agenda, or once people establish that, okay, this is the conclusion we came up with, they don't want to take in any new information that might change their conclusion, you know, and in some cases it's a matter of who's funding the research, right? And what reason are they doing the research? You know, they might be purposely looking for a certain conclusion.
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, look at examples. I mean, the fact is that this scientific community doesn't have a real good track record on a lot of things. I mean, think about how many decades we were told to quit eating butter and lard, and we need to have a hydrogenated vegetable oil. And now how much is safe? Zero. You know, we were told to sprinkle our kids' hair with DDT, and took, you know, well over a decade to connect the dots between that and infertile frogs and three-legged salamanders. We were told for decades to feed dead cows to cows, and it took about 30, 40 years to finally develop bovine spongiform encephalopathy, you know, mad cow. In 1979, the FDA gave us the food pyramid, which put Twinkies and Cocoa Puffs on the bottom, and then we're all wake up one day and wonder why in the world are our, you know, we got obesity and type 2 diabetes and everything, because, you know, the fact is, and now, of course, telling us to eat GMOs, that they're all the same, and, of course, the next one's going to be nanotechnology. You know, we're all going to be healthier with nanoparticles running through our veins and arteries. The fact is that the track record of this expert scientific community is actually not very good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a quote that, like, science, nobody has dug more graves than science. You know, it's one of those things where science should, I mean, it's the opposite of science to just have a established opinion and not constantly be looking for flaws or new information to you know, better understand the world around us. And you're right. I mean, in a lot of these cases, examples you brought up, there's a reason why that science was pushed. You know, the food industry pushed. You know, there's a good documentary called Sugar Coated. You know, and Gary Tobbs talks about it too. You know, how the sugar industry was a big part of. I mean, how many people today have diabetes, have lost loved ones, are overweight, all this stuff. Because of all this information that was pushed to our children, pushed to people for so many years, that fat is bad for you. Don't worry about sugar. Consume all the wheat and grains you want and all the sugar you want. Just watch your fat. And yet there's this increase in obesity and people being overweight and all this stuff. And then just look at the increase in disease and like, you know, allergies. I mean, I know vaccines are kind of a controversial issue. It's one that I've talked about in the past because I don't stray away from controversial issues. But I'm just one of those believers that it's like, you know what, everything should be questioned. And the same pharmaceutical companies that if you don't trust pharmaceutical companies when they're trying to sell you antidepressants that don't work and side effects are suicide and depression, then why would you trust the same pharmaceutical companies when they're trying to give your kids a billion viruses but yet they tell you to wash your hands when you pick them up. So you're saying that the child immunity is so sensitive that people should wash their hands when they pick them up, but it's completely okay to directly shoot viruses in their bloodstream when they're newborns. It doesn't make any sense. So I think it's really important for people to ask these questions and then look at our quality of food has gone down and the way we eat has changed. So has allergies, autism, cancer rates. I mean, there's all these things. I just had Dr. Thomas Seyfried on, about a month or so ago, and from the Boston University. I don't know. It's Boston College, and he has 150 peer-reviewed studies on the ketogenic diet. I've done a lot of shows on the keto diet and how it can prevent and cure disease, because inflammation is a big part of disease, you know. And we all understand glucose feeds cancer cells. So if you remove glucose from your diet, it can help fight cancer. And yet nobody is interested in this information because there's no money in it. There's no money in saying, hey, changing your diet can help fight disease. So who's going to want to fund that research, you know? So, I think we have to rethink medicine. We have to rethink a lot of what we call experts and think like, okay, who's paying their bills? And when markets and things like medicine becomes for profit, you know, the best interest isn't our health and isn't us.
The bottom line for me is that you have to just question all orthodoxy. The orthodoxy of the day, chances are the orthodoxy of the day is probably wrong. And when you start looking at the orthodoxy du jour, and you begin questioning it, then you're automatically placed in the role of heretic, right? You're a heretic because you're not, you know, bowing to the orthodoxy. But you're exactly right. The orthodoxy is a powerful thing, and orthodoxy defines, you know, cultural normalcy, and that of course then drives business. It drives government policy. Because government policy is there to protect the orthodoxy of the day, and it just becomes a self-fulfilling thing. So, questioning orthodoxy is one of the best things a person can do.
Yeah, I remember when you were talking about Ty Lopez on London Real, and you were saying he's one of the most curious people you've ever met, and that's kind of, you know, I always say I'm an expert in nothing. Like the only thing that I am is curious. That's probably my best talent, is being curious and asking questions and constantly looking for truth. And I always say, like, that's the best advice you can give your children, anybody, is just question everything and don't just believe it just because somebody you respect told you or whatnot. And I think it's really important, like you said, because you know, 100 years from now, we might look at ourselves now and be like, wow, those guys had it all wrong. They didn't understand, you know, and we've done it, you know, every generation as new discoveries have happened, that has happened where we look back and we're like, wow, they were dummies. They didn't know they didn't understand the world around us, you know, and there's tons of things we still don't understand, from like the placebo effect, you know, how come somebody can feel better just by thinking that, you know, a certain way or feeling a certain way, or like we talked about earlier on the show about the connection to nature. You know, they've people who walk around barefooted and on the grass, you know, they say that they feel better, and there's this sense of connection to the earth. And people outside who you know, they've seen where people outside their hospital windows, if they see nature and they see this beautiful trees and nature, they actually recover faster than people who see more hospital. Yes. You know, so I think that there's so that's something that we still don't quite understand. You know, even prescription drugs only have to be better than the placebo, you know, which means what? They have to be better than doing nothing, you know. So it's really not a high bar that they have to get to. But so it's all super interesting. I can't thank you enough, Joel, for being with me. I'm a huge fan of your work, and like I said, you know, growing up with being born on a farm, but I was raised in Massachusetts most of my life, but always my parents and stuff, all the stuff that growing up I didn't really appreciate until now. As I get old, I'm 33 now, but you know, as I got older, I was reflecting on all these things that I, you know, I'm glad I learned being around farmer parents and appreciation for things. So I think there's a lot of importance and stuff. And it's funny because we were talking about intelligence and stuff like that. And like, you know, my parents weren't educated, but there's, you know, I always looked at them like, oh, they're not that smart. But and then, you know, my dad will have a apple stem, put it on a pear tree and have apples grow from a pear tree. And I'm like, how the hell did you do that? You know, or however, you know, all these things. I'm like, you knew that you could do that. And he's like, yeah, you can't do it on this type of tree and that type of tree. And I'm like, okay, so you're smart. You're just smart in other, you know, in other things. You know, you're just not smart in according to our educational system, which really isn't smart anyways. It's just regurgitating information that you memorize. It's not really problem solving. I feel like farmers have amazing problem solving skills because when something breaks, you have to fix it. When something doesn't work, you have to resolve it, you know, and those are skills you don't get from just staying at a desk and just memorizing.
That's right. Well, very good.
Hey, thank you so much, Joel. I really appreciate it. I'll put the links to your Amazon books in the show notes and the links to your website and all that stuff. And and thank you so much. I really appreciate your work and keep up the great work. And hopefully we'll chat again in the near future.
Okay. Thank you, Ricky. Great. Hey. Wonderful to be with you.
Hey, you
Take
too.
Care.
Thanks. Thank you. Uh-huh. Take care.
Bye. Bye. I believe in the ripple effect.